This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Protests spread further across the Arab world this week. We check in with Egyptians in Cairo and Queens, New York. In Uganda, the president's doing something different to connect with dissatisfied youth. He's become a rapper, but not everyone's a fan.
We need more than just a song. We need action. We need to know that things are going to change. The youths have been left out of everything. Decision-making, employment.
And cooking up a storm for the Chinese New Year.
We made cookies like pineapple tarts. We even made seaweed jellos.
South Sudan is on its way to being an independent country. High on the to-do list, learn a new anthem. Around the world with the World Vision Report. But first, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava, sitting in for Peggy Wehmeyer.
I graduated. I work for a foreign embassy. And life is different depending on which social class you are part of. I'm better off than many of other Egyptians. But still, I share the same concerns that most of the Egyptians share. All of us are afraid of the future of ourselves and the country itself.
That is Ahmed Morsi. He's one of the hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square to protest against President Hosni Mubarak and to call for change. High unemployment and a growing gap between the rich and the poor have led to widespread anger and resentment. Aya Batrawi is a freelance reporter who lives in Egypt. Aya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Originally, we were told that the demonstrators were coming from across most of the classes. Is that still the case for anti-Mubarak forces in the square?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, this is a nationwide protest ending in Tahrir Square, if you would say. This is something that has been the calls of Egyptians, whether they be Muslim or Christian, whether they be rich or poor, educated or uneducated. And they have all suffered in different ways under the current situation with President Hosni Mubarak and the ruling party.
Back in 2008, there were riots in Egypt related to food prices. Initially this week, we saw some people holding up bread as a symbol of solidarity among those protesting against the government. How important are food prices this time around?
Well, a few weeks before the Tunisian uprising, Egypt saw inflation in the price of tomatoes. The kilo of tomatoes costs about 30 cents. Which is very cheap, and it shot up to almost 8 Egyptian pounds at one point. And so there weren't protests, but there was certainly criticism, and the government made sure to basically bring those prices back down in whatever way they could. But the majority of Egyptians rely 100% on government subsidies for their survival. They rely on the government to subsidize basic commodities from bread and rice and sugar and oil to petrol and many other basic goods. And so without the government subsidies, Egyptians will not be able to afford the normal price of these goods. But I think what really led to these protests among the poor was a sense of seeing that, number one, they could protest. That was a big thing. And then number two, I think the underlying feeling was that having to rely on government subsidies is not a way of life, and that this is just a way of surviving. And what people are now calling for is being able to live rather than just to survive.
Ironically, I've heard that this uprising has contributed to a new spike in food prices because of the curfew and supplies not getting in. Is that the case?
Yes, naturally, immediately after the protests began and the military curfew was imposed, prices shot up dramatically on everything from, you know, phone cards to cigarette prices and to basic commodities like bread and cheese and milk and all of that. But the government did step in and the prices have gone down. And I think now the president is very aware that providing food on the table and ensuring that people can eat may help him actually stay in power.
It's been reported that 40% of Egyptians live on $2 a day, and it's not just food that they can't afford. You spoke to someone on the streets in Cairo talking about not getting adequate health care. Let's give that a listen.
My name is Sadiq Muhammad Sadiq from Minya. It's been a year and a half since I submitted a request for shots. The health minister, Muhammad El-Ghabali, has, excuse me, $500,000 coming in every day and thousands of acres of land. I'm asking for shots for hepatitis C. I don't have. I haven't taken any because it's been a year and a half that I'm waiting. I want, by God's will, that Mubarak, the son of a doorman, who used to wipe floors, to leave.
Now, how indicative of the average Egyptian is that man?
You know, this man approached me actually when he saw me with my mic in Tahrir Square. You know, he really broke my heart, but I've been here for many years now in Egypt, and he looked like your average, very poor Egyptian, the kind you're talking about that live at just $2 a day or less, and he needs these shots desperately for survival. And he unfortunately represents such a large number of Egyptians. So what this man is essentially expressing is what many Egyptians fear, is that the money needed to invest in a proper education system and a proper healthcare system has not trickled down and has not been spent adequately.
Aya Betraoui, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Aya Betraoui is a reporter living in Egypt. An aging president who's been in power for decades, high unemployment, and growing discontent. It sounds familiar, but this time we're talking about Uganda, where President Yoweri Museveni has ruled with an iron fist for 25 years. Most Ugandans believe he'll win yet another term in the election on February 18th. But lately, lack of jobs and reports of corruption have given him a bad reputation among disgruntled youth. As Bonnie Allen tells us, the 66-year-old president is trying to strike a chord with young voters.
At a busy intersection in Kampala, a cell phone vendor in a wooden shack uses loudspeakers to blast out the most popular rap song in Uganda. It's sung by the president, Yoweri Museveni, in his traditional language with a catchy chorus.
You want another rap?
Sevo is a play on his last name, Museveni. Since its release in October, the track has become a huge hit on radio airwaves, in dance clubs, internet videos, and yes, cell phone ringtones. It's campaign magic for Museveni. More than half of eligible voters are under the age of 30. Here, at an outdoor basketball court, young men in their early 20s shoot hoops on a sunny afternoon. They were all born after Museveni became president, so he's all they've ever known. Smith Mira and his friends say they like that their leader turned rap star has a fresh image.
I think it was a great thing. Yeah, it was great for him and for our country.
I was like, yeah, I felt cool because everyone like is saying maybe he did that track for the youth.
I like that rap. It shows that he's a good politician.
Today, these young people talked to me about this rap because I was not following what they were saying.
The making of the rap song was a bit of an accident, actually. At a ruling party rally, Museveni told the crowd that he had just learned about this thing called rap from some youngsters. Then he chanted two traditional rhymes from his village. A savvy music producer gave it a beat, and voila, the rap star Sevo was born. Translated into English, some of the lyrics include, a hen gave me an egg that I gave to children, who gave me a monkey that I gave to the king, who gave me a cow that I used to marry my wife. It's a story of making something out of nothing, likely a metaphor for Museveni, who led the country up from the ruins of war. 23-year-old Smith Mira says he's a believer.
It was strange to talk about what he had done for us. From the time that he came into power, because he has brought peace, security, and organization in the country.
In the 1970s and early 80s, Museveni helped overthrow Uganda's most violent dictators, first Idi Amin, then Milton Obote. In 1986, he declared himself president, stabilized the country, and oversaw more than two decades of economic growth. But in recent years, Museveni's reputation has been tarnished by reports of corruption, the misuse of public money, election fraud, and limited job creation. Today, the majority of Ugandans live on less than $2 a day. Museveni has clung to power by revising the constitution that would have forced him to step down after two terms. At the headquarters of Museveni's ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, party spokesman Afuono Opondo admits that disgruntled youth want things to improve, but he insists that Museveni deserves loyalty for everything that he's accomplished.
From completely nothing to something plenty. We did not have roads before. We didn't have health centers at the village level before. We didn't have primary and secondary education. We did not have peace and stability in the country.
But inside the office of the Observer newspaper, managing editor James Tumusimi says the majority of voters are now too young to remember how bad things once were. So stirring up old memories may be irrelevant to them.
The main campaign platform of the ruling party is we are better than the past. I mean, the past being Idi Amin and Milton Obote. But then you have a new class of voters who hardly know Idi Amin, who hardly experienced it. And what they want is really the jobs and a good life for themselves.
To see if that's true, I've come to this crowded youth center near downtown Kampala. It's hosting a breakdance contest. Young men leap around the stage, busting out their best moves for an eager crowd. The youth here are dissatisfied. Moses Okello says what he wants is affordable university tuition and a job when he graduates, not a rap star president.
He was doing that to impress the youth, but the most important thing is that youth need jobs.
And for the young, jobs are scarce. According to the government, there's only one job for every 50 university graduates. 22-year-old Rashida Numolando is a rap fan, but she believes that 25 years in power has made Museveni and his party arrogant.
We need more than just a song. We need action. We need to know that things are going to change. The youths have been left out of everything. Decision-making, employment.
Both Numolando and Okello say they'd like to see a new president for Uganda, but fear many of their peers are either apathetic or afraid that voting for anyone other than Museveni will result in violence. Museveni's main opponent, Kizza Besigye, is trumpeting the slogan, "Change is coming." But it's not clear whether that's resonating with youth or whether they're listening to a different tune.
You want another rap?
For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Kampala, Uganda.
You can hear more of President Museveni rapping. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. We check in on what's happening in Sudan's south and north, and we mark the start of the Chinese Year of the Rabbit. That's still to come on the World Vision Report.
Rakara kembogo, rakara kembo karagan sharra, sharra munda yengoma.
You want another rap? You want another rap? You want another rap? You want another rap? That's wonderful. Now I know what you have been up to.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. The wave of protests that roiled North Africa the last couple of weeks hasn't stopped there. It has spread further into Africa, to northern Sudan. Rebecca Hamilton is a fellow at the New America Foundation and special Sudan correspondent for the Washington Post. She's just returned from a trip there. And she says that the protests in Khartoum last week had been brewing for a while.
There's been a rise in sugar prices. They have removed government subsidies on things like bread and fuel. And basically the conditions for people living in the north are just very, very tough right now. And because of the economic conditions, there's a problem with youth unemployment. These factors that really impinge on people's day-to-day life have been getting steadily worse. And you're seeing this all come together, and I think probably inspired by what has happened in Tunisia and in Egypt. People have started to take to the streets.
Students clashed with police, chanting "No to high prices," and Tunisia, Egypt, Sudan together as one. Government forces cracked down harshly on the protesters, and the situation there remains tense. Meanwhile, in the south of Sudan, there's jubilation. The first official results of last month's referendum show that more than 99% of the people in South Sudan voted to secede from the North and form their own independent country. Creating a single national identity is going to be a challenge. There are more than 40 ethnic groups in the South with a long history of tension among them. So the new government is rolling out symbols the people can unite around. A flag, a name, and of course, an anthem. Rebecca Hamilton says there are many other challenges ahead for the new country.
We're talking about a region, southern Sudan, that has been underdeveloped chronically for decades. So there are firstly a lot of infrastructure issues that need to be worked on. Most of the new country doesn't have paved roads. There is electricity in very few towns. And then there are basic public services, things like rubbish collection, access to clean water. None of these currently exist. You also have a population that has an illiteracy rate of 85%. So when you think about what that means for a new civil service that needs to govern this country, that's another challenge. And then almost the biggest of all is how to create a new national identity of southern Sudan among a people that are themselves ethnically incredibly diverse, perhaps 40 different ethnic groups across the south, and a history of tensions among them. And up until now, they have been unified to some extent to fight this common enemy of the north. Now, with independence and that northern enemy no longer being what it was, can they forge a new national identity that is able to transcend those ethnic differences?
Well, just before the vote began, the Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir angered Southerners when he said the South doesn't have the ability to provide for its citizens or create a state. Given decades of warring between the two parts of the country, one might put that down to lingering animosity. But is there any uncomfortable truth in that statement?
I was there when he made the statement, and of course people were furious, but unfortunately there is a ring of truth to it. There are a huge number of capacity deficits that need to be overcome very quickly, in particular because you have a southern population now that has enormous expectations about what independence will bring. And I've been traveling throughout the south, hearing from so many civilians on the ground about what they imagine will happen once South Sudan is independent. And they will say things like, we will have buildings for our schools. We will have new roads in our town. Every city will have electricity. Now, these are services that are going to be very difficult to deliver on, and in particular, difficult to deliver on in the quick time frame that people are expecting them to be provided within. But again, as much as one can be critical about all the things that are not yet in the South, it's been an amazing transformation just in these past 6 years. I remember the first time that I went to Juba. It's unrecognizable from what it is today. So I think it's worth also from time to time taking that step back and realizing how much they've done in such a short space of time, but also how very far there is to go.
Oil is the primary revenue source for southern Sudan. Peace pact 5 years ago, ending the civil war, spelled out a 50-50 split between north and south. How do you see that playing out?
Oil is, for both North and South, a huge part of their annual budget. For the South, it makes up 98% of their current budget. For the North, it's somewhere between 40 and 60%. So you actually have a vested interest in both North and South to keep that oil flowing. Both of them need it for their economic survival. And as much as in so many countries across Africa, this blessing of oil can be so much of a curse, there's at least a chance in Sudan that it will be the glue that ensures that both North and South keep at least moderately civil relations and ensure that the oil keeps flowing for the benefit of both of them.
Is there pressure now to renegotiate that oil treaty that existed between the North and the South?
Right. So there's the sharing of the oil revenues that was set out in this comprehensive peace agreement in 2005. That was only ever set to last for the period of the peace agreement. So that runs out on July 9th this year. And that process of negotiation is happening now. And what we're just not sure yet, there will be some oil sharing between North and South. There has to be, because the bulk of the oil is in the South, but the pipeline in order to get that oil to export runs through the North.
So both sides need something, and the debate is going to be exactly how to proportion it. During the peace agreement period, it was a 50-50 sort of deal, but I don't think that Southerners will accept that once they've got independence.
Now, can the South handle the huge influx of the returnees who've been coming back from the North? They came back to vote. One figure I saw was 180,000 people returning to the South where they had originally come from, and they're deciding to stay in the South. What happens then?
Yeah, and it's another one of those, you know, everybody will keep their fingers crossed questions. Certainly, the numbers of returnees are huge. You travel to any of the border towns, and day after day, I would just see more and more buses of people who had taken this long, you know, maybe 5-day journey from Khartoum and had spent really everything that they had to be able to get back to the South. And there's this question of expectations again. So many of them have an idea of what it will mean to belong to this new independent Southern Sudan. And those expectations are out of line with probably what the reality is going to be. That said, there is an enormous amount of goodwill towards these returnees. People were genuinely so excited to see these Southerners who've been in the North for so many years return. And the returnees themselves would say things like, you know, I'm not sure where I'm going to get money. I'm not sure how I'm going to feed myself, but I just really believe that because this is my homeland, this is the place where I belong, that things will be okay. And so the question is whether that enormous amount of goodwill is going to last long enough for the reality and the services to catch up.
Rebecca Hamilton is with the New America Foundation and author of Fighting for Darfur. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Pleasure. Thank you.
It's the start of the Lunar New Year, and this year it's the year of the rabbit. For Chinese people and those in other countries in the region, it's the most important holiday of the year.
저는 김의성이라고 합니다. 그리고 서울에서 살고 지금 나이는 27살입니다.
My name is Eui-sung Kim. I live in Seoul and I'm 27 years old.
좀 어릴 때는 세뱃돈도 받고 그래서
When I was younger, on Lunar New Year, all my relatives would get together and I would receive money from the older people in my family.
그래도 다른 명절보다는 설날
I loved it so much. Even now I look forward to the Lunar New Year more than any other holiday. My family members are so busy these days. It's hard for everyone to gather. But on that day we all still meet. We eat together, have traditional rice cake soup, play the traditional game of yutnori, and make really happy memories together.
Traditionally, for the Chinese New Year, people filled their homes with flowers and citrus fruit. They wore brand new bright red clothing right down to their underwear to ward off evil spirits. They avoided the number 4, considered bad luck, but favored the number 8, which symbolizes prosperity in the future. The Lunar New Year is celebrated in countries such as Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, and among Chinese immigrants in the U.S. Here's one Chinese woman reminiscing about how she spent the holidays as a child in Singapore.
It's the greatest festival of the year. My name's Margaret Tan. Or else can I say, I'm from Singapore. Our Chinese New Year began actually a month before the actual date by preparation. My mother had to bake cookies, and so we worked, so we made cookies like pineapple tarts. We even made seaweed jellos from actual seaweed, which we picked from the sea and dried. And then you boil it in water and sugar till it gets a golden brown. You remember that? So it was a whole month's preparation before the actual day began. The cleaning of the house, you have to clean and sweep out all the evil and all the dirt. I like this. They've had to pay their debts before the new year comes so that you start the year clean. We go visiting and you go to the elders. You go and you put your hands together and you kind of bow down in front of them and you say Ching Ching and Happy New Year. And they give you little red packages with money in it. And it was great fun because you go home and you count your money and see what you have collected for the day. Red package, you started the New Year with good luck. And one great thing we had at New Year's that I always enjoyed was the firecrackers. The Chinese businesses, they would string all these crackers, 200 packages or something, all together in one long chain, and they'd hang it over their balconies. Your shop is downstairs, and your second and third floor is where the family lives. And so they'd hang us down and fire it up just to drive away all the evil spirits. But for us children, we had our firecracker fights. I can remember that. We'd collect our firecrackers and then we'd hide behind any post and we'd light the cracker and throw it at each other. In a way, a little bit dangerous if you hit them, but usually you run away, you know, and you hide behind whatever post you could find. And that was great fun. To us, it was the beginning of a brand new year. Like, all your sins are forgiven, like you have, and all your debts are paid. Your house is clean. You've driven all the evil away. And you get all these packages of money and these new clothes. And now you start life anew. Happy New Year. I said, Kong Hei Fat Choy. Actually, when we were little, we used to say, Kong Hei Fat Choy, Hong Pao Lo Lei. That means, Happy New Year. Now I'm... Hand me the red package. I wish you all a happy new year.
That was Margaret Tan talking to the World Vision Report's Emily Eagle. Maricel Apatan is kept pretty busy this time of year. She's a chef in training at a 5-star hotel in the Philippines. Working in the kitchen there means a lot of slicing, dicing, mixing, and stirring, and precision is essential to keep up the high standards of the hotel. This is a challenge for Maricel. She has no hands. Simone Orendine brings us this story from Manila.
The pastry kitchen at the EDSA Shangri-La Resort in Manila is busy as workers put the final touches on an array of elaborate desserts. Near the stove, Maricel Apatan whips up Italian custard. A thin wire whisk is tucked tightly between her forearms as she mixes milk, cream, and sugar in a pot.
Bring to boil after this. Mix.
With the stubs of her handless arms, Apatan quickly separates cellophane-thin strips of gelatin that will thicken the custard. As she finishes, she looks up, her big eyes smiling, and raises her arm in a sort of fist pump without a fist. Apatan, a petite 22-year-old, is a culinary student who will graduate in a few weeks. Shangri-La sous chef Ariel Reyes says when Apatan first started her internship, he doubted whether she could do such manually intensive work. So he says he presented her with this challenge.
You can show me your capability on how you handle the knife, because I'm really afraid if you get a very sharp knife, you might hurt or you might be in trouble.
Reyes says he was impressed when he saw her cuts, which she demonstrates during my visit to the kitchen. Apatan slices strawberries to decorate a cheesecake. She tucks a sharp knife between her right forearm and her torso. Apatan keeps the row of berries in place with the stub of her other arm. She swivels her waist to push the knife back and forth on the cutting board. Apatan knows about knives and just how dangerous they can be. 10 years ago, on the day before her 12th birthday, neighbors ambushed Apatan and her uncle near their home in the southern Philippines. They hacked them with machetes. The neighbors were angry because in their poverty-stricken village, Apatan's family had won a contentious land dispute. Apatan's uncle got away, but she suffered deep wounds to her neck, back, and hands. After the attack, she remembers lying on the ground, trying not to move.
I saw their feet. I said to myself, they're still there. I'll close my eyes and pretend I'm dead. Because if they saw that I was awake, they might really finish me off.
Apatan made it home and was rushed, on foot mostly, to the nearest hospital. Her family had no money to pay for the hospital bill, but a distant relative, Archbishop Antonio Ledesma, agreed to help. He paid for Apatan's medical care and then placed her in a school for disabled children near Manila.
I was hopeful that if she can just keep her spirits up, she could still do something with her life. And I think we have to give credit to Maricel herself.
Apatan eventually earned a degree in hotel and restaurant management. Then Archbishop Ledesma's nephew gave her a scholarship to his culinary school.
Put the dough here inside and then close this one.
Apatan started at the Shangri-La Hotel manning this dinner roll machine, but her talent now is in toppings and decorations. Apatan doesn't like to dwell on the attack that disabled her. As she sits in an events room outside the noisy kitchen, she muses about what she could do with movable prosthetic hands, but quickly comes back to reality. Prosthetics are expensive.
Right now, it's not so important to have hands. It's more important to have a career.
What Apatan wants most of all is to lift her family out of poverty. She's the oldest of six siblings. Already, on her small salary, she's helping put a brother and sister through school. Sometimes, all three go without meals. Despite the lack of money and her disability, Apatan manages to keep her good humor. Back in the kitchen, she slips on a pair of oven mitts.
Just like a hand.
Apatan's gift is in her ability to focus on the possibilities of the future instead of lingering on the difficulties of the present. And the more time you spend with Apatan, the more you forget that she no longer has hands. It's like they're still there. You just can't see them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Simone Orendine in Manila.
Music helps the kids of Mexican immigrants connect to their traditional culture.
Even though I come from a family of musicians, I didn't listen to traditional music. I didn't like rancheras. As I got involving into it, I realized how beautiful it was, and then I really learned to appreciate it and love it.
That story ahead on the World Vision Report.
Hoy vuelvo a la frontera, otra vez he de atravesar, es el viento que me manda, que me empuja a la frontera y que borra el camino que detrás. Desaparece. Que detrás desaparece. Me arrastro bajo el cielo y las nubes.
I'm Melinda Pencava, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. In Mexico, folk music does more than just entertain. It's a kind of oral history, a way to preserve and pass on stories about life and communities. Children of Latino immigrants to the U.S. are often caught between the two cultures, and traditional music can help them connect with their Mexican roots. At least that's the goal of a Mexican art center in San Pablo, California. It's having quite a bit of success, as Madeline Baer reports.
The message is as clear as the notes of the tuba in the song Soy México Americano, off the newest album of Los Senzones.
Por mi madre yo soy mexicano, por destino soy americano, yo soy de la raza de oro.
Because of my mother, I am Mexican. Because of my destiny, I am American. I am from the Golden People. I am Mexican-American. The lyrics of this ranchera extol the pride of knowing two languages and two cultures. But for many Mexican-Americans, finding pride in a dual identity is not so simple. Take Lucina Rodriguez, one of the singers on this track.
I was born in Guadalajara, I was raised in Santa Anita till I was 11 years old, and then I came to this country, and I did not like being in this country.
From central Mexico, Lucina's family settled in San Pablo, a small working-class town across the bay from San Francisco. There was a new language, different food, and Latino gangs that caught recent immigrants in their crosshairs.
And so you really, you know, would walk on the streets with a lot of fear that you're going to get jumped, you know, and not because I'm a gangster, but just because I'm dark.
Outside of her home, Lucina found one place in town where she could let her guard down, Los Senzontles Mexican Arts Center, It's named after the Nahuatl word for mockingbirds because its classes in music and arts span the gamut of Mexican folk tradition. Much of it was new to Lucina.
Even though I come from a family of musicians, I didn't listen to traditional music. I didn't like rancheras.
Lucina wanted to sing like the pop stars she heard on the radio, but to tour with the center's performance group, she was required to practice the traditional Mexican styles.
As I got involving into it, I realized how beautiful it was, and then I really learned to appreciate it and love it.
That was 16 years ago. Today, Lucina is helping a new generation of students to embrace their culture. It's easy to miss Los Sensonles. The center is tucked into a strip mall on San Pablo's main street. Across the way is a casino, and a laundromat sits next door. The location seems more suitable for a liquor store, which in fact it was before Los Sensonles moved in.
Yeah, you take him out and then...
But walk through the doors on a weekday afternoon and it reverberates with life. The sound of boot heels bounces off the wooden floor. In the spacious main room, Lucina strums an 8-stringed Mexican guitar called a jarana and leads 7 children in Son Jarocho, a dance that originated on the slave plantations of Veracruz. Lucina's evolution from student to performer to teacher is exactly what musician Eugene Rodriguez envisioned when he created Los Sensonles 2 decades ago. Since then, hundreds of kids have taken classes, and dozens have performed on its albums, including the new Raza de Oro, which means golden people. Eugene, who is not related to Lucina, says the mission goes beyond arts education.
They hear music in their homes or in their parents' homes or their grandparents' homes that they develop a relationship with. Now, they may not acknowledge that relationship necessarily because they are listening to hip-hop or rock or whatever. But there's a point in their life when they start to say, okay, what does this sound mean to me?
For Maria Ramirez, that point came at an early age. The 14-year-old has been coming to Los Sensonles for 10 years. She says most of her Mexican-American friends don't know much about their heritage. Not Maria.
I started with dance, and from there I started doing Jarocho and Jalisquense. Then I started singing for a little while, but I stopped, and I've been doing a lot of percussion with the quijada, the pandero, the congas, and the drums.
The quijada is a donkey jawbone, the pandero, a tambourine. And it can be heard on Maria's favorite song she learned here, Voy Caminando, or I Go Walking.
It's telling pretty much the journey and the story of a man who's coming from Mexico and is immigrating to America here, but he's leaving behind his parents, his family, his, what he calls it, ranchito verde, which is like his land. Mañana voy caminando.
It's a story she could relate to. That journey is what brought her father to San Francisco, far from his native Durango. But until learning that song, Maria and her father had never talked about it.
I used to think that he just drove here. He just drove here from Mexico, but I told him about the song, and then he told me about how he came here and what he left behind.
6 years ago, he took his family back home, where Mireya surprised her cousins with Durango dance moves that she learned in California.
Because they thought that coming from America here, that I wouldn't know none of the traditions from over there. But I did, because I came here to Los Angeles.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Madeline Baer.
Madeline Baer met another young girl with eyes on a musical career, this time at a shelter for displaced people in Bogotá. Paula is one of 3 million Colombians who, by UN estimates, have been displaced from their homes because of the war between guerrilla fighters and the government. Most of these internal refugees are kids whose lives have been turned upside down. Here's Paula's story in her own words.
Yo me llamo Paula Andrea Martín Obregoso y tengo 11 años. Yo vengo de San José del Guaviare.
My name is Paula Andrea Martin Obregoso, and I am 11 years old. I come from San Jose de Guaviare, and I am now living here in the Perdón neighborhood in Bogotá. In San Jose de Guaviare, the scenery is beautiful. It's free. It's really hot. When I was about 4 years old, we were threatened by the paramilitary and guerrillas. So we had to leave there for here. I remember it all. My father taught me the music of our region since I was a baby, and I began to sing with the harp, the gaucho, the maracas. When I sing the music from my home, I feel like I'm back there, on the land, imagining the scenery. I like Green Path a lot because it was the first song I learned. It's about when you leave your land, but then a flower that you planted leaves behind blossoms. And so the path continues growing, with a garden, a flower bed, and it is all so beautiful that even though you left the land, it's like you practically returned.
Yo quiero ser una cantante profesional, conocer más países.
I want to be a professional singer, get to know more countries. I want to continue growing with my music, study more, learn all the instruments to play, the harp, find patrons, record albums.
You can see pictures of Paula at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Since this piece was recorded, Paula's family has moved to an apartment in a neighborhood in South Bogota. The war that caused all the upheaval for Paula and thousands of others in Colombia has been going on for more than 40 years. The Marxist rebel group, the FARC, is estimated to have lost half its members in the last 8 years. Many have been killed in military battles with government forces, but many others have deserted, lured by a government program that rewards guerrillas who put down their arms. They get amnesty or reduced prison terms. Reporter Nadia Drost spent time with one former rebel trying to make the shift to civilian life.
In a medical center in the Colombian capital, Bogota, 29-year-old Jairo sees a doctor for the first time in many years. Jairo isn't his real name, but for safety reasons, he's asked to use a pseudonym. When the doctor asks Jairo to lift his shirt, she notices scarred bumps on his torso. A shootout and stab wounds, Jairo explains, with his head down and his voice barely above a whisper. These are some of the scars from almost 20 years spent as a FARC guerrilla. I met Jairo for the first time 3 weeks after he'd abandoned the FARC. He'd only just arrived in Bogota. He wasn't allowed to reveal where he lived, so he came to my apartment to tell me his story. He explained that FARC rebels roamed freely in the rural part of southern Colombia where he grew up. When he was 12, a local FARC commander took him for a walk to a nearby guerrilla camp in the jungle. He was taught the FARC's ideology, that they are the people's army fighting for equality, and he learned how to use weapons. Within days, it became obvious Jairo would never be allowed to leave the FARC.
I grew up thinking they were like another member of my family. I cared for them a lot, but I missed my mom and siblings. But I was with the guerrillas, and they don't give you permission to leave.
For many years, Jairo was a combat guerrilla. But commanders eventually gave him a job only a few rebels were trusted with, human messenger. He ran USB keys and documents from one FARC camp to another. But Jairo says he'd begun to question the FARC's insurgency and the discrimination within its own ranks. And then, one day last spring, Jairo was sent to help rescue the survivors of a military bombing of a FARC camp. It was the same camp where his younger sister lived.
She was injured. She had shrapnel by her spinal column and on the other side of her lung. I said, "Little sister, I told you not to join the guerrillas, but you didn't listen to me." She started to cry and said, "Sometimes you make mistakes."
The FARC wouldn't allow Jairo's sister, who we'll call Sandra, to go to a hospital. 5 months later, they decided to escape so Sandra could see a doctor. They walked for 3 days to a town where they turned themselves in to the colonel in charge of a demobilization program for guerrillas who put down their arms. At first, Jairo and Sandra stayed in the battalion with some of the very same soldiers they'd probably fought against.
It's very hard. In that moment when you're right with them, you remember the past of seeing comrades dead in combat. I look at my sister who's injured and I look at them and I think, wow, because of them, she's like this. The soldiers offered laughter and friendship and we were talking. There we were, the enemy and us.
Sandro and Jairo were sent to Bogota to continue a 3-month demobilization program. They were given housing, health care, 2 sets of clothing, and a subsidy of $4 a day. On one of their first outings, they come here, to a medical clinic for checkups. The line stretches around the building. Sandra is hoping to have an x-ray to find out why the shrapnel is causing her so much pain.
I feel like when a bee stings you in my body, it's like taking my breath away. One has to survive the pain, because what else are you going to do?
Jairo is finally able to see a doctor, but Sandra cannot because the system hasn't yet updated her paperwork. After 5 hours in a waiting room, she's clearly disappointed.
All these 7 months have been like this, taking pills, and that's it.
When they leave, they go home to a high-security apartment. The government fears the FARC will seek out Jairo to punish him for being a traitor.
Now I have to be very careful, because they trusted me with a lot, and I know a lot of things about them. Logically, they will look for a way to kill me.
Naturally, he's suspicious of the people around him. In the street, if he sees a pedestrian leading with his left foot, Jairo wonders if he's a military soldier or guerrilla. Jairo is trying to change his own stride to walk, leading with his right foot, like civilians do. He's also trying to learn how to keep a budget, use a bank card, and maneuver the city's high-speed bus system. He's been assigned a psychologist to help him adjust to civilian life. But the road ahead remains daunting. Colonel Mauricio Luna coordinates the government's demobilization program.
There are some who joined the guerrillas very young, and that was their whole life. They had no other education, so they've been raised with many holes. When they arrive, they're timid, worried, lacking knowledge of many things.
A month passes. I meet up with Jairo again outside the library in his neighborhood. He tells me Sandra is still waiting to be seen by a doctor. Then he opens his wallet and takes out a photo tattered at the edges.
I have 2 kids.
Jairo shows me the pictures of his 7-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son. Their mother lives in one of the villages he visited during FARC missions. He hasn't seen his children in 3 years. And now that he's left the FARC, it's too dangerous to go back to the region where they live. Jairo is having to face his past and his future at the same time.
Once you're out, you see things differently. You see how much time was lost. Imagine, I'm 29, almost 30 years old, and I have nothing, no profession. I don't know anything.
Once he finishes the demobilization program, Jairo will receive a government subsidy while he takes a vocational course so he can learn a skill and earn a living.
I want to have my house, to have my kids, give them an education, and go forward.
So far, more than 18,000 guerrillas have abandoned the FARC for the demobilization program. But higher-ranking guerrillas are less likely to give themselves up because they'll face jail if they're found guilty of kidnapping or other serious crimes. But Jairo says he has no regrets about the day he left the FARC. He remembers staying up late into the night, talking to the soldiers at the battalion where he turned himself in.
We were saying it would be great if there wasn't a conflict in Colombia, all this killing amongst ourselves, because we're all Colombians. We're the same people.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nadia Drost in Bogota.
In Egypt, the situation continues to unfold. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away in Queens, New York, Egyptians gather in cafes and shisha bars to watch the news on TV and wonder what's next for their homeland. Here are a handful of voices from the neighborhood called Little Egypt.
My name is Mohammed Hossein. I'm 29. I'm from a place called Sharqiyya. It's about 50 miles away from Cairo. Well, it's about time. I mean, you have a guy who rules for three decades. You don't see that often in civilized nations. Corruption, oppression, people desperate. It just, people have to do something about it, right? I would think so.
My name is Mohammed Hassan. I'm an Egyptian immigrant, came to the United States like 6 years ago. I'm 32 years old. I am from Alexandria, Egypt. The financial problems that I faced in Egypt made me take the decision to immigrate to the United States. I can't even explain it. I know it's hard. What is in my mind right now is 7 days, the last 7 days of revolution. I went through three phases. Yes, I'm with you. No, hold it. No, I am with the president.
My name is Ali Mohammed. I'm originally from Egypt, Alexandria also. I think Egypt is going to the right direction. I have to really salute and I have to appreciate the young generation in Egypt. I have to give them credit. They did what we couldn't do 25, 30 years ago. They really did.
Voices from Egyptians living in Queens, New York, as told to reporter Lily Jamali. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can visit our website at worldvisionreport.org. And for this week, that's the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.